To speak about the Church of the Old Testament is a rare thing. Should I use this too? Okay. Okay. So ecclesiology in the Old Testament is a rare undertaking. In biblical, theological, and systematic studies, the focus is often on the New Testament church, with a rather cursory introduction of the Hebrew terms that are translated for the New Testament church. And these terms in Hebrew are Kahal, mainly Kahal and Edah, and then have been translated correspondingly as Ecclesia and Synagoge in the Septuagint. Often the argument in these studies of ecclesiology is on the relationship between Israel and the New Testament church, and often here the focus is on dispensationalist interpretation of salvation history, or on several other aspects of covenant theology and supersessionism. There are only a small number of ecclesiology studies that trace transitions and continuity from the Old Testament to the New Testament and view the church after Christ's resurrection not as a replacement of Israel, but as an expansion of God's promises and gifts to Israel. Much less is the research that has been done on the concept, nature, and characteristics of the church in the Old Testament. In an article focusing on the New Testament church, Gerald Klingbeil entertains New Testament church metaphors like family and body, and shows the possibility of a conceptual basis for an ecclesiology rooted in the whole of Scripture. A recent volume entitled Message, Mission, and Unity of the Church has been published by the Biblical Research Institute of the General Conference of Seventh-day Adventists, and several chapters in this book approach ecclesiology and from an Old Testament perspective. However, the focus is mainly on the topic of the mission of the Church. For example, Gerhard Fandel's essay discusses the identity, characteristics, and purpose of what he calls the people of God. He uses this terminology throughout his chapter, the people of God in the Old Testament, and he shows that throughout human history there always existed a people of God who submitted to God and witnessed to Him in a sinful environment. Jiří Moskala provides an overview of the mission of the church by looking at the different sections of the Old Testament. And then there is one chapter only that discusses specifically the missiological perspectives in the book of Daniel. So there is much left for an in-depth investigation about matters of ecclesiology in the Old Testament. And I would like to just throw out here a number of terms, for example, the nature of the church in the Old Testament, its function, its involvement in the world, its development, its structure, its leadership and authority, and so on. There are numerous topics that still are very much in the beginning stages or even untouched on ecclesiology studies. This study today will in its largest part engage the narrative text of Exodus, the book of Exodus, and look at a time when the church in the wilderness, and note this was Stephen's expression that he used before the Sanhedrin in according to Acts chapter 7 verse 38, when he told the story of that church in the wilderness. So this paper today discusses this narrative text about the church in the wilderness, how this church was founded, how it came to exist, why it came to exist, how it developed over the course of 40 years in the wilderness, and how it would be projected for its future. I will deal briefly with the terminology in the Old Testament used for ecclesia or church, and then enter into four sections entitled, entitled beginnings, rationale, dynamics, and visions of the church. The presuppositions for this study that I would like to point out right here in the beginning are, first, the church in the Old Testament is not a religious idea. It is not an idea that is built on Hebrew terms and expressions and language that should then be translated and transitioned into the New Testament church and language only. Number two, the church in the Old Testament is not a metaphorical visualization of the future Christian church. And number three, the church in the Old Testament is not an organization institutionalized on a system of doctrinal beliefs or policy. So I will keep these presuppositions in mind as I discuss the narrative of the book of Exodus and go into other sections in the Pentateuch and outside of the Pentateuch, and will show that the church in the Old Testament is a real church, a church that deals with its matters in a real and active way during the time of the wilderness, of the 40 years in the wilderness, that it is recorded as a story of the people of God, and it is based on a relationship, not on a working policy. It is based on a relationship to the Creator God and to the world as a whole. Terminology. Among the Hebrew expressions used in the Old Testament to indicate communities of religious purpose are three words that are synonymous with regard to their ecclesiological semantic component. These three words are Am, the people, Kahal, the assembly, and Edah, the congregation or assembly. While only Kahal has been translated by the Septuagint into the Greek term ekklesia, which is the church, Edah was used for the translation of a synagogue, the synagogue of the Jews in the first century. And this word, Eda, is also used with other Greek terminology that are not of as great an importance for this study today. Scholars do not see a major discernible difference between the two terms, Kahal and Eda, inside the Hebrew Bible itself, whereas the Septuagint uses the one for ecclesia and the other one for synagogue. The Old Testament does not make this strong difference between the two words. Old Testament scholars also perceive an inadequate assessment of Kahal and Edah when they are looked up merely as precursors of the early Christian church. We do not do justice to the words, to the expression, to the concept of Kahal and Edah inside the Old Testament if we use them only to point to the New Testament church. In the context of the Old Testament, Kahal stands as a technical term for an assembly of people in their performance of cultic, legal, or political duties, whereas Edah often qualifies the purpose of such an assembly. It often will tell us what took place, the topic of this assembly, the occasion, and other matters, why it took place. The expression Am for people that I mentioned in the beginning is can be looked up in the study that Gerhard Pfandl did in the book Mission and Unity of the Church. So today, in this paper, I will refer to this church in the wilderness, as Stephen called it, before the Sanhedrin, and will point out significant events that tell of its beginnings, its reasons, why this church was established, the dynamics that drove the church, and the visions of this church for the future. The beginnings. The beginnings of the church in the wilderness are highly important to understand its foundation, to learn about the different perspectives about the founding of the church told in its story, in its biblical story, and to examine the events that set the basis for this church. An ecclesiology of the church in the Old Testament needs to study this term, church in the wilderness, in order to understand the background for that New Testament church that revived after Christ's resurrection and ascension. Number one, about the church in the wilderness, the first part that is interesting to mention is, how did God view this church? How did God start it? When the Israelites arrived at Mount Sinai, God entered into a covenant with the people. These were former slaves. And he became their God. The first words that God spoke when he addressed the people were totally personal words. They are expressed in Exodus 19, verse 4, with the expression, "I brought you to myself." The people had arrived at Mount Sinai, yet God brought them to himself. A very personal, intimate expression that shows God's friendliness, God's longing for these people that he had expressed already in ancient times to the patriarchs. A church that has such words to remember as words of its beginnings understands that the church came into being inside the heart of God and through his gracious and divine acts. The personal relationship finds much stronger words in the following expression in verses 5 and 6 in Exodus 19, where God says, "You are my own possession. You are to me a kingdom of priests and a holy nation." Often we use this word in the context of the conditional clause, "If you obey, you will be my own possession," or "you will be to me a kingdom of priests and a holy nation." A closer analysis of the Hebrew terminology of this conditional terminology in Exodus 19, verse 5, and in the context of the entire Pentateuch, however, shows that Moses himself, when he used that conditional formulation, that he rather used it in the context of a strong promise of God, that how God viewed these people. Because in the book of Deuteronomy, when Moses speaks his final words to the people, he uses the very same phrases. God's possession, you are God's possession. So, and he does not link to it any conditions in that sense. So when God introduces himself to the people at Mount Sinai with a line that he will often repeat, with the line, "I am the Lord your God," and the personal pronoun "your" that is attached as a suffix to the word God in the Hebrew text is a singular pronoun. And then this singular pronoun will be followed in the rest of all of the Ten Commandments. This expression shows that how God views his church, how God views these people. He does not view them as a crowd, as a big mass of people standing before him at the foot of Mount Sinai, but he views them as individual Israelites. He looks at a man, he looks at a woman, he looks at a child, he even looks at the stranger who has dared to join this community, this church. The covenant stipulations that we understand follow in the Ten Commandments were therefore highly personal words. Personal words of promise of a God who values life in its relational aspects more than conformism to the letter of the law. And it is Christ himself in the New Testament who will constantly remind the scribes and Pharisees of this issue, the personal relationship of God who has brought the people into the covenant with himself. Even when one views the Ten Commandments as legally binding covenant terms, for God's people to guard the life of the church member, even if one views the Ten Commandments in that way, to isolate them from their relationship context means to misuse and abuse them. Number two, how does the church in the wilderness perceive those first moments with God? Immediately when God finishes speaking his 10 words, the focus shifts to the reaction of the people, and this reaction seems not to have been positive. The people are afraid, and the people approach Moses and place Moses in between themselves and this God who has come down to enter into a personal relationship with them. So the people assign to Moses a place in this story that God had not intended actually for him to have. So whenever something did not go the way in later on during the 40 years, whenever something did not go the way that the people expected it, that a God would function, that he should give them everything they needed in every situation, then they would approach Moses, and Moses would suffer the consequences of his position that he suddenly had in the midst of these people. What is the perspective of the leaders of the people in the context of this covenant making that occurred at Mount Sinai? Exodus 24 tells of the leader's perspective. It tells of Moses and the 70 elders, Aaron and his four sons, going up Mount Sinai and meeting God. So there we have leaders meeting God personally, sitting down with him, and the text goes as far as to say they saw God, whereas later on God will state that no one can see me and live. They saw God, they sat down and ate and drank. So there we have leaders who are in the very presence and direct proximity with God. Down at the foot of Mount Sinai, a crisis unfolds. And we have to skip Exodus chapter 25 to 31 and then come to the crisis that takes place at the foot of Mount Sinai. There, a surface reading of the chapters 32 to 34 ascribes the crisis that takes place with the building of the golden calf as a crisis of the entire people of Israel. It talks about the people in a very broad sense and as a big mass of people. However, a more detailed analysis discovers parallelisms that occur between Exodus 32, the building of the golden calf story, and the previous section with the leaders up there on Mount Sinai in Exodus 24. And these parallelisms show that the people in the golden calf narrative react, actually, to the covenant ritual that had been performed by their leaders in the narrative of Exodus 24. For example, in Exodus 24, Moses built an altar. In Exodus 32, Aaron will build an altar. In Exodus 24, sacrifices of burnt offerings and peace offerings are specifically mentioned and were offered up to God in the covenant ritual that was made at Mount Sinai with the leaders. Whereas in Exodus 32, when Aaron had built the altar, he offered sacrifices of burnt offerings and peace offerings, the very same sacrifices also. In Exodus 24, the narrative tells us of a pavement of a sapphire stone, the precious stone, the beautiful stone in the story of God's presence at his feet. And in Exodus 32, precious materials that the people used and had brought with them from Egypt, earrings, gold, were taken to Aaron, and Aaron built the golden calf. In Exodus 22, the leaders on the mountain saw God and ate and drank. We could speak of a celebration ritual that was performed for the finishing part of the covenant making there. Whereas in Exodus 32, the people also celebrated a feast. Aaron initiated a feast for the next day, and the story tells that they ate and drank, just like the leaders up on the mountain. In Exodus 24, the glory of God was like a consuming fire. That is how it looked like and appeared to the people. And in Exodus 32, God's anger will burn, and with the intention to destroy the people. So there are a number of parallels that occur between these two chapters, the leader chapter in Exodus 24 and the crisis of the people at in the camp. So to conclude on these parallels between the two sections, I would like to suggest that what we have here in front of us is actually a leadership crisis. A leadership crisis because those leaders that were up on Mount Sinai, the 70 elders, the sons of Aaron, even Aaron himself, are conspicuously absent in the story of the building of the golden calf. Aaron is present, but he is present because he has been pressured by the people to perform things that end up in a very disastrous way there. And even the rationale that he provides when Moses comes to question him, why did you do that? It is very, very strange and not at all in a reasonable way. When he says that I threw all those things into the fire and out came this calf. So the church in the wilderness in Exodus 32 is a pretty abandoned church, a church that has been abandoned by its leaders. Moses delayed, the people hold, Moses delayed, and we do not know what has become of him. We are left alone. We are down here, and nobody tells us what is going on for such a long time. So when church leaders fail to take their church into the awesome presence of God that they have experienced, yet fail to do it for their church, here is the outcome. How does God and Moses deal with the apostasy of the church in the wilderness? The narrative in Exodus 32 to 34 contains evidence of enormous initiative and activity from the part of Moses. He will deal first with Aaron, he will question him about that calf, and he will deal with the people in the camp. And there is a section that is truly frightening when he asks those men of the tribe of Levi to take their swords and go from gate to gate and kill their neighbors, and so many people. So by the end of the day, there will be so many dead. He will deal first with the situation down there, but then he will go back and forth between the camp of Israel and the mountain of God. This event shows Moses as the greatest human intercessor in the history of the church. About 40 different intermediary activities may be observed if one reads carefully those chapters in Exodus 32 to 34, where Moses speaks, where Moses acts, where Moses invents all kinds of way on how to repair the covenantal breach that had taken place and restore the relationship. Note that I speak of a relationship that existed. Whereas it appears that the narrative in Exodus 32 to 34 suggests that God viewed the situation as hopeless for his presence to be with them and to continue and go with the people into the promised land, whereas this appears in this way that God finds this hopeless situation, it is Moses who did not give up. His reasoning, however, in the presence of God was not based on a more positive picture that he had in mind about those people, not at all. He did not view the situation as not that bad. But his perspective was that it was God himself. He had a different way of God and his nature of a God who had initiated the relationship with these people already in patriarchal times. He reminds God of his promises given to Abraham and the other patriarchs. And he reminds him of his miraculous acts when God had brought out Israel from the Egyptian slavery. Such a God, according to Moses, could not give up on the people. And the language that is used there in Exodus chapter 33 shows some of this understanding that takes place. Note the words that God uses when he says that he cannot and will not go with the people. In Exodus 33, verse 3, God says, "For I will not go up in your midst, because you are an obstinate people, and I might destroy you on the way." Note the reasoning that God employs. However, when Moses, after all the procedures that he has gone through and all those steps that he has taken to heal the process, to bring back the relationship, note the very same words when he says, "If now I have found favor in your sight, O Lord, I pray, let the Lord go along in our midst, because the people are so obstinate." The same expression in the original language. The translator did not come along with it because he says, "even though the people are so obstinate." However, the Hebrew used the very same words. "I will not go up because the people are obstinate." And Moses says, "Lord, I pray, go because the people are so obstinate." Now, how did Moses arrive at this understanding that he needs God because of the hardness and stiff-necked people they are? How did he arrive and how did he get God to come to the point where he agrees to his prayer? For example, in chapter 33, verse 15, Moses approaches God in a prayer and he asks him, "If your presence is not going," and he will stop. He will not continue to put more pressure into his words and into his prayer. Just, "If your presence is not going," what will happen then? In the next verse, he takes another step and he says, "Lord, please go with us." And then we find the section in chapter 33 where Moses is up on the mountain in the cleft of the rock and God will pass before him and Moses will see the glory. And there we have the great announcement about the graciousness and loving kindness of God. And after he has perceived that, Moses phrases his words to God the same way as God had done in the beginning and says, "I pray God, I pray you Lord, go with us, go in our midst, not just go with us, but be in our midst because the people are so stiff-necked." And he will add to that, "and pardon our iniquity, our sin, and take us as your own possession." When this situation comes to an end, with all the activities that Moses has done, he also puts in the midst of that, he put up the tent, one of those, a tent, but placed it outside of the camp. So his intercessory work did not just happen on a vertical level, that he would go up and entreat God and come back and speak to the people, but his intercessory ministry took place just as much on a horizontal level. Because the text reports to us that Moses put up a tent outside the camp, and he was very, very much observed. He was watched in this situation. When he would go out to that tent where the Lord would come and meet him in the cloud, the people would go out of their tents, stand in the entrance of their tents, and watch him pass by. So there is a ministry that is going on inside the camp, down there in the camp at the foot of Mount Sinai, where Moses plays this great intercessory role between God, the people, but just as much in between the tents. People come out, people meet each other when they come out of their own tents. Is it possible that during this period of time, reformation took place among the church in the wilderness? That healing took place between those families who had lost somebody that was killed because of the building of the golden calf? The text at least suggests this possibility. When that comes to an end, this entire episode of the story of the golden calf and Moses' intercessory work, the story of the deepest crisis that the Pentateuch reports about the people of Israel, this story is couched or embedded in between two great sections. And these two great sections are about the construction of the sanctuary, instructions that God gives in chapter 25 to 31, and then the construction or realization of the building in chapters 35 to 40. The final point of God's instruction to the sanctuary is about the great appointment that God will have with the people, a weekly appointment on the Sabbath. In Exodus chapter 31, verses 12 to 17. When Moses then greets and gathers this very same assembly that has built the calf, that has apostatized and rejected God in that disastrous way, when Moses assembles the same church, he will speak to them, and his first words are about this event of God meeting people on Sabbath. That is a very interesting structuring that the book portrays there in the narrative of the Exodus. Now, how do we come to understand the rationale or the reasoning why would God take these people into his possession? We have read about it already in Exodus 19, verse 5, where God says, "You are my own possession." Why? "Because all the earth is mine." So if all the earth is mine, God says, then I will take you as representatives and as ministers to this earth. He will make them ministers when he establishes them as kingdom and as priestly nation. In chapter 25, verse 8, he will say, "I establish you, and I will dwell with you and dwell among you." In verse 22, in the same chapter, he will go even further when he says, "I will meet with you inside that building, the sanctuary, and I will speak to you there." Yet all this building is framed by the Sabbath section there. How does the church continue when they will start to go on from this part? This section is about the dynamics of the church. How will it continue? Church dynamics are often concerned with church size, with number of the members. Yet the book of Deuteronomy tells us of a very different way of analyzing the dynamics of the church. There will be positive forces that drive the church forward, and these are recorded in Numbers chapter 1 to 10. And then we will find negative forces that will be posed especially from chapter 11 onward in the book of Numbers. I will skip over this section and will come to my last point, where I discuss the vision of the church for the future of this wilderness church. You see, in the middle of the negative forces that drive the church forward, and forces that come from the inside of the church and from outside, from all directions. There are negative forces that come from all the people, that come from their enemies from the outside, that come from the leadership and even from the top. Even Moses himself turns against God. Note that. And in the middle of all of that, we find the vision of God. Numbers 22 to 24 tells us of God's vision about this church in the wilderness, and it is so much different than the rest of the book of Numbers. Namely, there we have a prophet, a strange prophet, Bileam, who is called to curse Israel by the enemy, the Moabite king. How different is the vision that he portrays from the rest of the book? Whereas the story surrounding Bileam's four visions tell of the grumbling inside the camp, whereas they tell us of accusations that are hurled towards the leaders, whereas the book of Numbers tells of rebellion against the leaders, against God, and even of the leaders themselves, when Moses speaks against God, and where we have people dying in great numbers, the visions of Bileam coming from God, who resided actually in the middle of that camp, in the middle of the church, portray a totally different view. They speak of a people blessed and not cursed. They speak of a people without iniquity, and here again the translator had difficulty to use the word without iniquity, and he uses the word a people without misfortune for the word avon, which is iniquity in the Hebrew text. The vision tell of a people without trouble, because the Lord is with them. A people with the majesty of a lioness, beautifully organized like a designed, lush and fruitful garden, powerful among the nations, and with a king arising who will overcome all surrounding enemies. What a perspective from up there on the mountaintops that Bileam proclaims. Yet the visions are not his, but are given to him by the God who was directly and daily affected by what was going on down there and inside the camp over the course of 40 years. He dwelled in their midst. The word "in the midst" in the book of Numbers has great importance. It occurs 47 times. And it is a God who himself had ordered this camp, and yet and asked the camp to be undefiled, to be clean throughout, yet the most unclean place inside the camp existed in the midst. It was the sanctuary of God himself, where all sin was dumped into it. He had ordered the organization of that camp. He had invited every church member, every man, every woman, regardless of gender regulations. He had invited every person without restrictions of race or tribe to associate with him. He had even invited the ones who were in other parts restricted by infirmities of their bodies. He invited them to dedicate their lives to him in a priestly manner. The Nazarite way of life and ministry in number 6 even surpassed the ministry of the priests in the sanctuary. So when Moses continued in his final speeches to this wilderness church and spoke to them before they entered the promised land, the book of Numbers contains sections that are of enormous significance to understand this church. He spoke of a church that celebrated God, a church that included each member of their society, that did not make distinction between gender and race and class, a church that transformed the lives of the Israelites when they approached the sanctuary three times a year at the festivities of this church. And the passages in the book of Deuteronomy will use a triad of expression that mentions the poor, the orphan, and the stranger, always in a similar fashion and in a similar sequence, where the tithe is given to support these people, to support them. And where the disempowered triad that usually occurred in the society now has extreme importance and is placed even before the Levite and the priest who will live from the tithe. In this perspective, justice that comes from God is done. Other visionary aspects of the church will come later on in the Old Testament passages, especially in the book of Isaiah and of Joel. Here, the two prophets speak of a church in the future that will be all-inclusive. It will be a cosmic eschatological church that will not separate between people. It will include the foreigner just as much as the Israelite. It will include even the one who, in the society of the ancient times, was an excluded person by Mosaic law. The eunuch, the one who had crushed testicles, had no right to stand in the presence of God. Here in the vision for the church for the future, these two are mentioned as representatives to be included in God's future church. Joel's final aspect is of a non-discriminatory spirit church. The prophet Joel elaborates that on the day of the Lord, God will pour out his spirit on all flesh. So from where did the Old Testament church derive its origin and authority? From a God who founded the church on stipulations rooted in a personal, individual, and intimate relationship because of his saving activity. From a God who placed the Sabbath's wideness and non-inclusive language and message into the heart of his covenant relationship with the human beings. The Adventist church, while upholding the Sabbath as mark and seal of God, but missing the Sabbath's all-inclusive message, loses its relevance in this world if it does not witness to it. Thank you so much.